are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of
a
our
A date
line.
Which will live in infamy.
Tune in to KBOO on election night, Tuesday, November 8th at 6 p.m. for our live midterm election coverage. We'll have coverage that counts from local, county, state, and national races. Our anchors will be with you while the vote tallies come in, and we'll also feature analysis from your favorite KBOO hosts. That's KBOO's live midterm election coverage starting at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, November 8th. Don't miss it.
KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, keeping Portland safe and in touch. Support your independent community radio station, KBOO. You can donate via the KBOO website at kboo.fm/give. There's also a donate button in the mobile app, or you can text KBOO to 44321. But the best way to support KBOO is by becoming a member at kboo.fm/give. KBOO is a nonprofit, listener-supported community resource for people like you. This is Wider Window Poetry, and I am your host, Teal Ansari, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. But first, a word about the places where you are. KBOO Portland is located on land that includes traditional village sites of the Multnomah, Wasco, Cowlitz, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Molalla, and many other tribes who made their homes along the Columbia and Willamette Rivers, creating communities and summer encampments to harvest and use the plentiful natural resources of the area. Portland is home to almost 70,000 people descended from these tribes and many others. As a latecomer to this region, descended from slaves and immigrants, I thank the indigenous peoples of the Portland area for this place of refuge. This month I'm celebrating Asian American poets. What is an Asian American poet? Or what is an Asian American? Or what is an Asian? Asia makes up 30% of Earth's land area and contains 60% of the world's population. It includes over 50 countries, including the two most populous countries in the world, India and China. Countless languages are spoken in Asia. India alone contains over 800. And for an idea of the cultural diversity of what we call Asia, consider that it includes Turkey, Iran, the Philippines, Russia, Indonesia, Japan, and many others. What then can it mean to be an Asian? Every poet you will hear on this program identifies or has identified themselves as an Asian American. Maybe we did it out of pride in our heritage. Maybe we did it out of convenience, because it's hard to sit people down with an atlas and explain that there's no such place as Asia. Maybe we did it because we were offered the opportunity to self-identify and thought that's cool. Maybe we did it out of a sense of commonality, of the shared experience of being immigrants of whatever generation, people who had to bring what they could and leave everything else behind. People who would always be regarded as others in the land that would always be their home. Be that as it may, here we are. I'm going to start by reading a poem of my own titled Descent, and it's dedicated to Garrett Hongo, who is a very fine Asian American poet of Japanese descent. Garrett was here in Portland a few years ago, and I had the opportunity to meet him in person. And one of the things he said at that time was, descent is a very fragile thing. Descent, for Garrett Hongo. Don't worry, I won't call you grandfather. I'm a little old for that. And anyway, my grandfather passed on years ago. He took with him the last of my roots in a land where doorways are built round, sails are square, a land that built a wall 1,000 miles along its border, It's so funny that Donald Trump thinks he invented that idea. A land where dragon kites adorned the sky, where women's feet were crushed and bound and rotted in their wrappings. A land whose language he never left behind, and I never learned. Dissent is a very fragile thing, you said. Very fragile. I understand the words for rice and tea, although I can't pronounce them. Won't eat rare meat, don't like most kinds of cheese. Can tell Mandarin from Cantonese by ear, but don't recognize a single ideograph. Buddhism was not the door that led me to the Sufi path. I'm not the pine tree on a mist-shrouded mountain whose gnarled trunk has outwatched dynasties. Dissent is a very fragile thing. Roots are easily severed. Let me offer you instead a bounty of leaves. This is Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, celebrating Asian American poets. I'm going to play a block of poems here. Most of the poets will introduce themselves and their poems, and some will have additional things to say about their poems, so I will just read the names of the poets and the titles of their poems. We're going to hear Arthur Hsu reading Winter Star, Rita Banerjee reading Sleep, Brandom Sum reading Shinadas, Zana Hashem Beck reading There, There, Grieving, and Hu Min Nguyen reading Chasm.
Winter stars. You'll never forget corpses wrapped in flames. At dusk, you watched a congregation of crows gather in the orchard and sway on branches. In the dawn light, a rabbit moves and stops along the grass. And as you pull a newspaper out of a box, glance at the headlines, you feel the dew on grass as the gleam of fading stars. Yesterday, you met a body shop owner whose father was arrested, imprisoned, and tortured in Chile. Heard how men were scalded to death in boiling water. And as the angle of sunlight shifts, you feel a seasonal tilt into winter with its expanse of stars. Candles flickering down the Ganges, where you light a candle on a leaf and set it flickering downstream into darkness. Dozens of tiny flames flickering into darkness. Then you gaze at fires erupting along the shore. There are so many worlds to this world. The spark to this poem came from a chance encounter with a body shop owner here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I was having my daughter's car repaired and Ismail Mena, the owner, came in. We started a conversation about immigration. Mena's father drove up and after a brief introduction, he told me a few harrowing stories about what it was like to live under the Pinochet dictatorship in Chile. His descriptions haunted me, and as I started writing, I recalled visiting Varanasi many years earlier. My wife and daughter and I found a boatman and boat, and we went out on the Ganges River at night. We moored near a cremation ghat where corpses were in various stages of burning. We then drifted, lit candles on leaves, and let them float downstream into darkness. In writing, the interplay of fire and water emerged. Then, a few months after completing Winter Stars, I realized it was only a beginning. I wrote for 8 more months and developed a group of loosely connected poems, which became the suite Sprang. Finally, I hope these notes show that my writing process connects to Theodore Rethke's line, I learn by going where I have to go. Thank you.
Sleep by Rita Banerjee. What does it mean to be so still to glide along the ocean floor like some black-tongued electric eel, to burn through marbled gold and green of oceanic things like some compact mass deforming space, time, a void within voids, and then it is easier to imagine amphibian, to know that blood too can change its temperament as quickly as salamanders change skin, as quickly as eyes of newt and tongues of dog become incantations, enchantments of art and life, just as an animal submerged underwater becomes unknown, just as respirations become primitive and breaths and motions cease, as a lone fish in a dark pond arrives as an object of thought and becomes stone.
Hello, my name is Brandon Song, and I'm going to be reading my poem, Shainavas. I'm honored to have the poem included in Best American Poetry Series. I want to thank Paisley Rekdal and the editors at the series, as well as Bill Carty at Poetry Northwest, where the poem first appeared. The poem reflects on a story that my tata, my maternal grandfather, Ted Mendoza, used to tell me about his childhood in Phoenix, Arizona, and his love for movies and movie stars. The poem begins with a epigraph from the poet and artist Jose Montoya from his famous poem, El Louis. The epigraph reads, Ese Louis, chale, call me diamonds now. Shainalas. He shined shoes as a boy for movie money, and I imagined how a shine box might fit under the theater's seat, the way it fit decades later when I saw it in the dark beneath my grandparents' old sunken spring bed. Later, bulldozed, the Phoenix Theater must have looked like those pre-war cinemas, mostly lost now, but documented in the photographs of Hiroshi Sugimoto, for which the artist placed his large format camera in the last rows of spring shut seats below ornate wall carvings and Baroque sconces, where he then left the camera's aperture open for a full feature. It is what we see of stars, all endings and untouchable beginnings, images, characters, and plot gone, and only white light left. The cedar box, housing brushes, rags, and tins of polish at its hinged latch, and the handle that also cradled a shoe. My foot's never touched it, but I wonder which brush inside might brush back against the grain one of those photos to extend the wet finger of projection over a boy who looks up toward the screen like he looked up from a shine. Or is the figure to borrow from the other invention? Could I carve open a pinhole in the shine box for a storehouse of inverted images, as if revolutions were that simple an apparatus of optics to have the shiner ascend there to what shines?
Hi, this is Zina Hashim Beck, and I'm reading There, Grieving. Where are you from? There. Where are you headed? There. What are you doing? Grieving. Rabi' al-Adawiyya. Little brother, we are all grieving and galaxy and goodbye. Once I climbed inside the old clock tower of my hometown and found a dead bird, bathed in broken light, like a little Christ. Little Christ of our hearts, I know planets light years away are under our tongues. We've tasted them. We've climbed the staircases saying, there, there. Little brother, we are all praying. Every morning, I read out loud, but not loud enough to alarm anyone. Once my love said, please open the door. I can hear you talk. Open the door. Little Christ of our hearts, tell anyone you've been talking to God and see what happens. Every day I open the door. I do it by looking at my daughter on a swing, eyes closed and crinkled, teeth bare. I say, good morning, you little beating thing. Little brother, we are all humming. More and more as I read, I sound like my father with his book of prayers, turning pages in his bed. A hymn for each day of the week, a gift from his mother who taught me the 10 of diamonds is a win, left me her loose prayer clothes. Bismillah. Little Christ of our hearts, forgive me, for I loved eating the birds with lemon and the sound of their tiny bones. But I couldn't stomach the eyes of the fried fish. Little brother, we are always hungry. Here, this watermelon. Here, some salt for the tomatoes. Here, this song for the dead birds in time boxes and the living. That day in the clock tower, I saw the city too, below. The merchants who call, the blue awnings, the corn carts, the clotheslines, the heat, the gears that turn, and the remembering.
My name is Human Wing, and I'll be reading my poem, Chasm. Monthly, my family calls from Vietnam to inform us about the dead. Their voices amplified through the speakerphone while my mother sits upright in her bed, performs a variety of mundane tasks, sewing, word finds, removing nail polish. Of course, I want to assume things. Dead body, dead butter yellow lawn. If I try hard enough, I can gather each story like marbles into my mouth, spit them into the drain, and watch as hair climbs out. Every month, a new body washes up in conversation. A great aunt, a dog, a cousin or two, but now it's my father's first wife. 4 days dead in her bathroom, my uncle says. She lived alone, abandoned years earlier by her husband, buried in a backyard somewhere in that roadside village. The woman he left in Vietnam to come to America, he promised he'd return for her and their two sons, but instead married my mother. Well, she was found dead, 4 days dead in a bathroom my father once built for her, buried in my uncle's backyard. He had to kill the dog too. It kept trying to dig her out. Either anyone can be forgotten, or only the forgotten can bring forth a good haunting. Spanning the chasm of the living, above which a bridge made of ghosts, full of ghosts, waiting to be summoned through the receiver, one by one, by dead one, I can see them all, gathering in the pixelated air, a patch of light ruptured by dust. I know my mother will make a great ghost one day. They love her, the ghosts. They watch her all the time, she knows this. But she just sits there unbothered, biting the seam of a white dress until it splits.
You're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. This is Wider Window Poetry, celebrating Asian American poets. Next, we're going to hear from Kava Basari reading The Invention of I, W. Todd Kaneko reading Where the Sky Meets the Earth. Khalid Matawa is going to share two poems with us, and then we're going to hear from Matthew Altman reading, I love this title, Letter to the Person Who, During the Q&A Session After the Reading, Asked for Career Advice.
Hi, my name is Kaveh Basiri. I'll be reading my poem, Invention of I as in the pronoun. But first I have to say how amazing it is to be part of this celebration of Asian American poetry. I'm so grateful to everyone, especially Paisley Rectall and Copper Nickel, which first published the poem. My poem is in two parts. Invention of I. One. In Farsi, I was given the name, but I wasn't a hero. In English, I became a white man. In Farsi, over 2,500 years ago, a new god was found. In English, there is still only the one god. No one found another. In Farsi, if you take bread from a verb, you make history. In English, for a perfect past, it isn't enough to exist. You must have things. In Farsi, the present isn't so simple. In English, the simple past isn't so simple. In Farsi, you can assume who is behind what happened. In English, you need to catch them in the act. In Farsi, enemy is the vice that ends with me. In English, enemy is a friend that isn't me. Two. In English, I was taught the author is dead, I was free. In Persian, I learned fana, to kill the self and serve it to God. In English, what you have doesn't follow you into the present. In Persian, my past is imperfect. In English, we capture with an army of nouns. In Persian, we guard them with a veil of adjectives. In English, I celebrate myself. In Persian, children of Adam are members of one body. In English, we are proud and stand by what we do. In Persian, everything gets in the way of our deeds. In English, I hear the cuckoo asking, who are you? In Persian, I hear the owl asking, where is he? My poem is about my experience as an Iranian American. It took a long time for me to feel comfortable writing about my experience as an immigrant and to appreciate being in between languages. I didn't want to repeat a cliched immigrant story or to be a spokesman for Iran or to gain empathy and publications because of political circumstances. But I also didn't want to deny my heritage or to avoid writing about subjects that mattered to me. Invention of I and my chapbook, 99 Names of Exile, which includes the poem, are the result of my attempts to write about my family's experience. Invention of I explores what it means to be an Iranian or an American or both. It reflects on the role language plays in shaping who we are. In my case, a fractured identity, a refracted I. The poem plays on the different characteristics of the two cultures and the grammatical rules of Persian and English. It begins with in Farsi because it evokes the time I grew up in Iran and was learning English. Iranian language is called Farsi in Iran. The second part considers my life in America, where English is my main language and the Iranian language is known as Persian. The poem was originally longer, had many more examples, but then I decided on a page limit and picked my favorite lines. Thank you.
This is Todd Kaneko. This poem is called Where the Sky Meets the Earth. A man can't die where there is no earth, because there will be no place to bury him. His body is the sky and understands the language of birds. His body says the earth is made of everything that has fallen from heaven while no one was looking. He promises to defy gravity and then return home. A man can't reach for the sky and not feel he is falling. It goes on forever, and the birds talk about the awesomeness of flight, while the oxen labor in the fields, while the cows eat grass and dream of slaughter. A man can't talk about flight, because one day there will be no sky, just the body covered in earth. And now the sky is empty of birds. And now the earth is covered in flowers.
Hello, my name is Khaled Al-Mutawa, and I will read you two poems today. The first poem is Qasida to the Statue of Sappho in Mytilene. It is a poem to Sappho, who is the great ancient poet of Greece, and her statue is in the city of Mytilene on the island of Lesbos. Qasida to the Statue of Sappho in Mytilene. Kyria, why do you stand askance, facing neither sea nor mountain, not even toward your wild flower fields? And the lyre on your shoulder, was it meant to be the size of the plastic jugs shouldered by Moria's refugees? I saw them in Sicily too, home of your first exile, where no rescue could pause time's grating on their memories. Your island is empty of poets, Kyria. I came to meet them, to recall the trembling earth under my feet. Hangers-on, reporting to newsletters, throng the cafes, researchers hacking at field work, polishing CVs. The migrants are all court poets now. At night, they labor to translate their traumas into EU legalese, or sit at your feet shouting into cell phones to scattered relatives trying to try the code of the model asylee. Kyria, there's no way for me to see you, no date or sculpture's name, only fascist graffiti below your knees. Why do your eyes glare lifeless like apricot pits, your stone body dim, a paper lamp trembling in the breeze? Or is that you now, Kyria, wearing hijab, holding your Clayus's hand, glad to be home again, but not quite at ease? The next poem I will read is Psalm of the Volunteer. It is dedicated to the rescuers and volunteers on the island of Lesbos. Dear world, who am I to condemn you? Dear eyes, who am I to blind you? Dear lies, who am I to chastise you? Dear ignorance, who am I to float above you? Dear hypocrisy, who am I to claim not to know you? Dear self-righteousness, how am I to subdue you? Dear soul, who am I to shun you? Dear soul, who am I to shelter you? Dear soul, how am I to repair you?
Hi, my name is Matthew Olsman, and this poem is called Letter to the Person Who, during the Q&A session after the reading, asked for career advice. The confusion you feel is not your fault. When we were younger, guidance counselors steered us toward respectable occupations. Doctor, lawyer, pharmacist, dentist. Not once did they say exorcist. snake milker, or race car helmet tester, always investment banker, IT specialist, marketing associate, never rodeo clown, never air guitar soloist, chainsaw juggler, or miniature golf windmill maker. In this country, in the year I was born, some 3.1 million other people were also born, each with their own destiny, the lines of their palms predicting an incandescent future. Were all of them supposed to be strategy consultants and commodity analysts? Water slide companies pay people to slide down water slides to evaluate their product. Somehow that's an actual job. So is naming nail polish colors. Were these ever presented as options? You need to follow your passion as long as your passion is not poetry and is definitely a hedge fund. If I could do it over, I'd suggest an entry-level position standing by a riverbank, or a middle management opportunity winding like fog through the sugar maples of New England. There's a catastrophic shortage of bagpipe players, tombstone sculptors, and tightrope walkers. When they tell you about the road ahead, they forget the quadrillion other roads. You'll know which one belongs to you because it fills you with astonishment or ends with you being reborn as an alpine ibex, a gravity-defying goat, able to leap 7 feet in the air, find footholds where none exist, and, without imagining it could ever be anything else, scale a vertical sheet of solid rock to find some branches, twigs, or wild berries to devour. All right, so a note about the poem or what inspired the poem. It was actually a type of question like the one mentioned in the title, a question about how to be an artist, how do you know you can do this or that this is what you're supposed to be doing. And I thought of that question long afterward. Usually I say things and think of better things to say much later. And this question had a similar feeling where I didn't exactly feel like I had the right words in the moment, but I loved the question. It reminded me of something I might have asked years and years ago when I was trying to figure out how to be a poet on my own while going to poetry readings in Detroit. I'd go to readings or concerts or art openings, and the possibility of being an artist and seeing people who could do that, it just all seemed very, very mysterious and impossible to me. So the poem responds to an actual question, but also feels like it's addressing that younger version of me, someone who was and is a little strange and uncertain about everything, but also very earnest in trying to figure it all out. Thank you.
This is Wider Window Poetry on KABOO, KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. We're celebrating Asian American poets this month, and we're about to hear from Rajiv Mohabir reading Ode to Richmond Hill, Ryana Shirali reading Oja Rituals, Victoria Chang reading Privacy, Adrian Sue reading Peaches, Jennifer Tsung reading Dear Nai Nai, and C. Dale Young reading Portrait in Graphite and Ornamental Hagiography.
This is Rajiv Mohabir reading my poem Ode to Richmond Hill. Then the drunk teen scatters a cascade of copper on cement. The old uncle yells, eyes silver with disbelief. Pick up your paisa naman. No worry, on this slate day, youths them speak no Hindi to know paisa means money. A taxi speeds by, blaring a chutney remix of Kaise Bunny. And you remember your aji dropping her rum at auntie's party to jump up, and your mother's awkward Hindi. You bit your fingers with each roti she rolled, each mantra she taught you floods your throat, in front of this puja shop front on 127th and Liberty, strung with plastic marigolds. A replica strung of polypropylene, like you are now, and not like long time when Baraja came from India. You are a forgery that will one day burn, not on a pyre, but in an incinerator, not on a riverbank, but in a crematorium, your prayers in Hindi accented in English alveolars, neither devas nor prophets recognize as supplication. But on Liberty Avenue, in the waft of a spliff drag, and sandalwood, a coolie uncle in a kurta mouths Marley. As you walk by, you start to sing praise to queens, where you are Chandra Sun or so-and-so Borike Pikni. where you wipe oil from doubles on your jeans and cuss up the car that backs into stacked crates of strawberries, to where you return after 3 years, and Richmond Hill opens its coolie arms, pulls you close, and in your ear whispers, "This time, na long time."
This is Rena Shirali reading the epigraph for Oja Rituals. Ojas are medicine men, the ones next to God, religious ministers or priests who deal with the daily struggles of the village people. This dynamic allows the village Oja to control the circulation of rumors, and he is the village member who has the power to trap dayans, or witches. In some trials, the Oja reads grains of rice, burn marks on branches, and disturbances in the sand around his residence for signs of a dayan. Oja, rituals. Certain beliefs precede his name, and yet he goes by many: Devar, Bhagat, priest. Passive ear, the kind of listener you'd give your own face. First, the village must agree that spirits exist, some benevolent, some deserving of fear. Everyone wants their universe to have reason. So it must be a woman who stole your portion of rice, woman who smeared your doorsteps rangoli, woman who looked sideways at your child. Give him your gossip, and the Oja conjures herbs to appease the evil, her raving, innocent mouth. And by that token, what is truth? The other rumors, too, could corroborate that bullets pass through, his body barely there, but for the holy in his hands. He chants her name with fingers pushed into his ears. Just the sound of her bangles undoes. A single woman on a plot of land, unbecoming. He reads her guilt in grains of rice, in the light of a lamp, using a cup which moves and identifies, makes a circle around himself. White sand between him and the world. It's the dead hour. Now, he shouts, arms covered in ants. Sing.
Hi, my name is Victoria Chang, and I'm going to read this poem called Privacy. Privacy died on December 4th, 2015. My child brought a balloon that said, "Get well soon," to the gravesite. This time, Peter Manning lay next to my mother, a stranger so close to her. Before this other stone appeared, my mother's stone was still my mother because of the absence around her. The appearance of the new stone and the likeness to her stone implied my mother was a stone too, that my mother was buried under the stone too. On the day of the burial, I hired a Chinese priest. I couldn't understand many of his words because they were not about food. The men who had dug up the dirt stood with their shovels and waited. I looked at their eyes for any sign of drowning. Then I noticed that one man's body didn't have a shadow, and when he walked away, the grass didn't flatten. His shovel was clean. I suddenly recognized this man as love. This poem is a part of a series of poems that all look kind of like this. They're obituaries and from my book, Obit. And I wrote them maybe 8 months or so after my mother passed away from a longer illness called pulmonary fibrosis. And my father, in the meantime, was also sick. He had a stroke around that time. So for me, grieving wasn't one catastrophic event. It was kind of little bits and small pieces and fragments of things dying. And so This poem is a part of that series, and there are just a bunch of other things like my mother's lungs, language, memory, form, appetite, the obituary writer, America. For me, during that time period, and even now, since my father's still alive but still sick, there are still little bits of things that are passing on a daily basis, and so that's where these poems were inspired from.
This is Adrienne Sue, and I'm reading my poem, Peaches. Peaches. A crate of peaches, straight from the farm, has to be maintained or eaten in days. Obvious, but in my family, they went so fast, I never saw the mess that punishes delay. I thought everyone bought fruit by the crate, stored it in the coolest part of the house, then devoured it before any could rot. I'm from the Peach State, and to those who ask, but where are you from originally, I'd like to reply, the homeland of the peach, but I'm too nice, and they might not look it up. In truth, the reason we bought so much did have to do with being Chinese, at least Chinese in that part of America, both strangers and natives, on a lonely, beautiful street, where food came in stackable containers and fussy bags, unless you bothered to drive to the source, where the same money landed a bushel of fruit, a 20-pound sack of rice. You had to drive anyway, each house surrounded by land enough to grow your own, if lawns hadn't been required. At home, I loved to stare into the extra freezer, reviewing mountains of foil-wrapped meats, cakes, juice concentrate, mysterious packets brought by houseguests from New York Chinatown, to be transformed by heat, force, and my mother's patient effort. Enough to keep us fed through flood or storm, provided the power stayed on, or fire and ice could be procured, which would be labor-intensive. But so was everything else my parents did. Their lives were labor. They kept this from the kids, who grew up to confuse work with pleasure, to become typical immigrants' children, taller than their parents, and unaware of hunger, except when asked the odd, perplexing question.
Jennifer Zuck, Dear Nai Nai. Dear Nai Nai, every day you sink into her to make room for me. When I die, I sink into you. When Xing dies, she sinks into me. Her child dies and sinks into Xing, and the earth, who is always ravenous, swallows us. I don't know where you're buried. I don't know your sons' names, only their numbers and fates. Number 2 was murdered. Number 3 went to jail. Number 4 hung himself. Number 5, who did the cooking and cleaning, is alive. Number 1, my father, died of pancreatic cancer, of bacon and lunch meat and Napoleon's. Your husband died young of double happiness, unfiltered. You died of time, of motherhood, of being the boss, of working in a sock factory, of an everyday ailment for which there is no cure. I am alone like a number. Number 1 writes me a letter. My dearest Jenny, do you know Rigoberta Manchu, this name? There were also silences about Chinese girls, Oriental women. In field of literature, you must be strong enough to bear all these. An ivory tower writer can never be successful. You are almost living like a hermit. Are you coming home soon? He doesn't mention you. Perfect defect. Hidden flaw in the cloth, yellow bead in the family. regalia, bidden to be understory, silences poured and poured over. You are almost living. You say hello to me quietly. What is success? Meat, pastries, cigarettes, the cessation of communion with self. I want to be eaten by an ivory tower, devoured by the power of my own solitude. We're alone together. I read the letter every day before death. Where are you buried, Nai-Nai? I'm coming home soon.
This is C. Dale Young reading my poem, Portrait in Graphite and Ornamental Hagiography. Portrait in Graphite and Ornamental Hagiography. You may not believe it, but I have tried. Set my sights on the morning star in belief it would guide me. I have tried. I have tried, as the Jesuits taught, to be singular, to be whole, to be one. The labor of this was exhausting. Time reveals things one need not appreciate when young, and I fear being singular, being one, is something damned near impossible for someone like me. Saint Jerome, cloistered in a tiny room, found his singular calling in updating the Latin Bible with his knowledge of Greek texts. In Assisi, Saint Francis updated nature, called birds out of the trees. I am, unfortunately, no saint. Fractured, divided to the quick, I am incapable of being singular. And the old nun who taught art at my high school, who called me a stupid mongrel, understood this very fact long before I did. Profession, family, belief. I can see now my background challenges me, prevents me from remaining true to only one thing. The fog settled over Ocean Beach settles the matter by embracing everything indiscriminately, and I want to understand why I notice such things. For most of my life, I have desired a category, a designation, but maybe that desire was misplaced. Maybe it was just another failure, a failure of imagination. Outside, two hummingbirds cross-stitch the air. They have lived here for so long, lived off the nectar I boil up for them each week, that they show me no semblance of fear or distrust. They hover and feed near me with violent precision.
You're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. This is Wider Window Poetry, and we're going to finish up this month with Monica Yoon.
Hi, my name is Monica Yoon, and my poem is called Study of Two Figures, Pasifae Sado. And it requires a little bit of explanation. There are two figures in the poem. One is from Greek mythology, and the other is from Korean history. And so Pasifae is the wife of King Minos of Crete. And the gods send a white bull from the sea, and King Minos is supposed to sacrifice it to the gods, but instead he keeps it for his own herds. And in revenge, the gods cause Pasifae to fall in love with the bull. So she commands the inventor Daedalus, who is then working for them, to make her a wooden cow. And she gets inside the cow, hides there, is impregnated by the bull, and gives birth to the Minotaur, the monster. And the Minotaur is imprisoned in the labyrinth, which is also made by Daedalus, and is eventually killed by the hero Theseus. And the Prince Sado is a figure from 18th century Korea. He's the crown prince, and he gets married. He has a son, and who will in turn be the heir to the throne. And then he seems to go insane. His insanity takes a number of forms, but the most problematic of which is he rapes and kills probably about 100 courtiers in his madness. And this poses a dilemma for the king, his father. If Sato is declared a criminal, then that criminality will taint Sato's entire family, his wife and his son, which will mean that the grandson will also be removed from the succession. There will be no heir. The same thing will happen if Sato is declared insane. And so what the king does is, on a hot July day in Seoul, he commands Sato to appear before him and to apologize for his crimes, which Sato does. The king then asks for a rice chest to be brought. A rice chest is a wooden box. It's like 4 foot by 4 foot by 3 foot. And the king asks Sato to get into the box, which Sato does. And the king orders for the box to be closed. Eventually, it's bound with rope. Grass is heaped on top of it. And about 8 days later, Sato dies. Study of two figures, Pacifici Sato. One figure is female, the other is male, both are contained. One figure is mythical, the other historical. To the extent that one can be said to have existed at all, they occupy different millennia, different continents. But to the extent that one can be said to have existed at all, both figures are considered Asian, one from Colchis, one from Korea. To mention the Asianness of the figures creates a racial marker in the poem. This means that the poem can no longer pass as a white poem, that different people can be expected to read the poem, that they can be expected to read the poem in different ways. To mention the Asianness of the figures is also to mention, by implication, the Asianness of the poet. Revealing a racial marker in a poem is like revealing a gun in a story, or like revealing a nipple in a dance. After such a revelation, the poem is about race, the story is about the gun, the dance is about the body of the dancer. It is no longer considered a dance at all and is subject to regulation. Topics that have this gravitational quality of aboutness are known as hot button topics, such as race, violence, or sex. Hot button is a marketing term coined by Walter Kitchell III in a September 1978 issue of Fortune magazine. The term evokes laboratory animals and refers to consumer desires that need to be slaked. The term hot button suggests not only the slaking of such desires, but also a shock or punishment for having acted on those desires, a deterrent to further actions pursuing such desires, and by extension, a deterrent to desire itself. Violence and sex are examples of desires and can be satisfied, punished, and deterred. Race is not usually considered an example of desire. Both the female and the male figures are able to articulate their desires with an unusual degree of candor and specificity. Both are responsible for many sexual deaths. The male figure says, "When anger grips me, I cannot contain myself. Only after I kill something, a person, perhaps an animal, even a chicken, can I calm down. I am sad that your majesty does not love me and terrified when you criticize me. All this turns to anger. Your majesty here refers to the king, his father." The female figure is never directly quoted, but Pseudo-Apollodorus writes that she casts a spell upon the king, her husband, so that when he has sex with another woman, he ejaculates wild creatures into the woman's vagina, thereby killing her. Although the punishment is enacted on the body of the woman, this punishment is meant to deter the king from slaking his desires. Both figures are angry at the king, but neither attempts to kill the king, which would be political. Instead, they displace this anger onto other unnamed deaths, which are considered sexual, but not political. Both figures have spouses known for strategy, for self-preservation in politically tumultuous times, times of many unnamed deaths. Both figures are counterfoils to their strategizing spouses, figures of excessive desire, requiring containment. Both containers are wooden. Both containers are camouflaged with a soft, yielding substance, one with grass, one with fur. Both containers are ingenious solutions to seemingly intractable problems. One problem is political, one problem is sexual. They are both the same problem. They have the same solution. The male figure waits in the container for death to come. He waits for 8 days. His son will live. This ensures the succession, the frictionless transfer of power. The female figure waits in the container for the generation of a life. We do not know how long she waits. Her son will die after waiting in his own wooden container. This ensures the succession, the frictionless transfer of power. There are many artistic representations of both containers. The male figure's container is blockish, unadorned, a household object of standard size and quotidian function. Tourists climb into it and pose for photos, post them online. The cramped position of their bodies generates a combination of horror and glee. This in turn creates discomfort, the recognition that horror and glee should not be combined, that such a combination is taboo. The female figure's container is customized, lushly contoured. Its contours are excessively articulated to the same degree that her desire is excessively articulated. Artists depict the container in cutaway view, revealing the female figure within, awaiting the wild creature. The abject position of the female figure, on all fours, pressing her genitalia back against the hollow cow's genitalia, generates a combination of lust and revenge. This, in turn, creates discomfort, the recognition that lust and revenge should not be combined, that wild creatures and female figures should not be combined, that these combinations are taboo. Hot-button topics are taboo because they generate discomfort. The male figure slakes his violent desires and is punished. The male figure also functions as a hot button, a means whereby the violent desires of tourists are slaked while generating discomfort in those tourists. The female figure slakes her sexual desires and is punished. The female figure also functions as a hot button, a means whereby the sexual desires of artists are slaked while generating discomfort in these artists. The tourist can climb into the rice chest. The tourist can pose for a photo in the rice chest. Then the tourist can climb out of the rice chest and walk away. The artist can look into the hollow cow. The artist can render the contours of the hollow cow, the contours of the female figure. Then the artist can walk away. Both containers allow the tourist and artist to touch the hot button, the taboo. The desire and the discomfort remain contained. Both containers allow the tourist and the artist to walk away. The male and female figures remain contained. Neither container, the rice chest, the hollow cow, appears to have any necessary connection to race. To mention race, where it is not necessary to mention race, is taboo. I have not mentioned the race of the tourist or the artist. The tourist and the artist are allowed to pass for white. The tourist and the artist are not contained. I have already mentioned the race of the poet, but to the extent that the poet is not contained, the poet is allowed to pass for white. I have already mentioned the race of the male and female figures. The male and female figures are contained. The rice chest and hollow cow are containers. The rice chest and the hollow cow are not the only containers in this poem. Colchis and Korea are containers in this poem. Asianness is a container in this poem. Race is a container in this poem. Each of these containers contains desire and its satisfaction. Each of these containers contains discomfort and deterrence. Each of these containers contains a hot button, a taboo. The tourist and the artist can enter each of these containers. The tourist and the artist can touch the hot button and walk away. Each of these containers separates the slaking of desire from the punishment of desire. Each of these containers is an ingenious solution to a seemingly intractable problem. They are the same problem. They have the same solution. Each of these containers ensures the frictionless transfer of power. Each of these containers holds a male or female figure. The name of the male figure can be translated as think of me in sadness. The name of the female figure can be translated as I shine.
You are tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about